Good morning. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. First up on the show today, a new year is right around the corner, and so is a new Congress. Lawmakers are reporting to work on Thursday, and the balance of power in D.C. looks very different than it did in 2018. Plus, it's day 10 of the partial government shutdown with no compromise to pass a funding measure in sight. We'll dig into it with our weekly politics roundtable. Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist and founder and chief executive officer of Rodriguez Strategies, is in studio with me now. He's also a former senior Obama advisor in 2008, and he tweets at Rod Strategies. Hi, Matt.
How are you?
Very well. Thank you. Happy New Year to you.
You too.
Shanti Walsh is also on the line, Republican political analyst and partner at Wilson Walsh Consulting in San Francisco. He's a former advisor to California Governors Pete Wilson and Arnold Schwarzenegger, also worked in the White House staff of Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Hi, Sean.
Hey, Libby.
Very good to have you on the show again. So a new divided Congress is coming to town, and it's a particularly dysfunctional moment for all of this to be starting up. Senator Richard Shelby, who's a Republican from Alabama, told Margaret Brennan on Face the Nation yesterday that budget negotiations are at an impasse.
Right now, we're at a standoff, and I think that's not good for the Senate, the House, or America. We can do better, and we've got to figure out a way, Margaret, to get to yes. If we blame each other, this could last a long, long time.
Sean, Senator Shelby went on to say that no one really wins in this shutdown. He said both sides look, quote, silly. Do you think that that's the truth? Are there any winners out of this scenario?
I don't know. I mean, we've had, since 76, when they actually changed the laws, had about 20 shutdowns, about four of them significant shutdowns. And every time there's been a shutdown, there's been kind of a chipping away at what actually gets shut down. So, you know, short of going out in the Arctic tundra of a national park or trying to spend New Year's Eve maybe at the Awani Lodge in California, I'm not sure how many people in America actually know there's a government shutdown.
Hey, a lot of people head out to Joshua Tree around New Year's from Los Angeles, and I've heard that there are some issues with the pit toilets there, Sean, if you want that information.
Well, I guess bring a porta potty. The Veterans Affairs Administration is still serving people.
Sure.
Security checks are still going out. Vital defense and law enforcement activities are still occurring. So, you know, when is a shutdown really a shutdown? I don't mean to diminish it. It's embarrassing on a. We've had a lot of embarrassing happen over the past couple of years, but it's embarrassing on a global level that we just really can't seem to get our budgetary act together. And you got to wonder what China and Russia think of us every time we go through one of these escapades.
Yeah, Matt Rodriguez in the studio with me. You know, Democrats have said that President Trump already has this $1.3 billion that was previously approved for the wall, mm-hmm. and very little of that has been spent.
Yeah.
And they also are claiming that the goalposts in this negotiation keep kind of moving and are mm-hmm. a little bit muddied. Do you think that Democrats are more dug in this time around than on previous budget showdowns? I'm getting the sense that Nancy Pelosi, about to pick up the gavel on Thursday, is giving them a bit of a backbone.
A backbone. I also think Democrats don't see a real reason to move on this. First of all, you have a couple of different things going on. The first is both sides are really playing to their bases. So you have Trump, who immediately was looking at a deal and then all of a sudden walked away from a deal because the Ann Coulters and the Rush Limbaughs of the world had a meltdown. And so he did an about face. He was the one who basically said, look, if there's a shutdown, I'm willing to shut the government down. It's all on me. And recent polling has shown that the public is blaming Trump. Not surprisingly, he said, I'd be proud to shut the government down. He did it. And that's where we are. So I think for now, one, Democrats don't feel a real need to move. And I think there's no room in the Democratic base to give him any of this money for this wall. And on Trump's side, I think he makes the calculation, and Sean has mentioned it as well. These shutdowns tend to be a big deal while you're going through them. People seem to forget them pretty quickly. I mean, even I've forgotten there had been three shutdowns, you know, over the course of the last year. And so I think Trump looks at this and says, look, my base is never going to forget this, that I stood strong. And at some point, the public's going to – we're going to cut a deal and the public will be happy again, or they won't even care one way or the other. And so I don't know if there's a lot of incentive right now, at least for either side, to do a lot. As far as Democrats go, yeah, I don't think they plan on giving him anything. It's a toxic issue for the Democratic base. And I think they look at Trump and say, this guy's completely out of control. So we're just going to wait until he comes up with an actual plan that looks like it's viable. And that hasn't happened yet. It's just been a bunch of angry tweets, at least over the course of the holiday season.
Sean Walsh on the line. Do you think it's going to take federal workers that are not getting paid for a length of time where it actually, you know, hurts their bottom line? We're already hearing about contractors who won't be getting paid and are furloughed without pay. And they, a lot of them are paycheck to paycheck type workers. Will people's individual experiences with the shutdown, once the economic hurt is actually felt, push both sides to come back to the table with a better compromise?
You'd like to think so, but I don't think so. I was in the Bush White House when we actually had a shutdown then, and ironically then it actually was very, very painful, and very painful for the Bush administration. I just think since we've had so many of these now over the past 30-odd years, people have somewhat become a little bit dulled in their senses, and you do feel bad for the guy who may be, you know, doing repair work out in Utah at one of the air bases, who's a contractor who's, you know, doing machine shop stuff, and you know, that hurts real people. But, you know, I think the issues are too big. And as Matt said, the politics are too dug in. The Democrats actually have an advantage right now. I also think that if Nancy Pelosi or some of the Democratic leadership that seems to have held their positions gives in too much on this issue, that you'll get a very activist piece of the left that actually did fairly well at this election cycle on the Democratic side, you know, raising a lot of hackles. So I just don't think that the Democratic leadership wants to have a fight with their own membership over Trump's border wall.
Yeah, we saw Lindsey Graham emerging from a lunch with the president yesterday and floating a compromise that would mean work permits for DACA recipients, not a path to citizenship, but work permits for several years. Lindsey Graham appears to be trying to broker some sort of
something.
Yeah, I guess a fig leaf for this an olive branch is what I'm looking for. Do you think the Democrats are willing to budge when it comes to concessions for DACA recipients?
Well, they've already gone down the DACA road earlier. That was what one of the earlier shutdowns was all about. And so there was talk about giving DACA for some funding. This was a while ago. I don't think that's going to fly now, one, because I don't know if Trump's going to be able to get cover from his own base for that. And two, I just think Democrats, as of now, they're not going to do anything until Trump actually has a real policy that he sets out, because it's clear that all these other people, if you notice, all these other people are floating things for him. It was Pence, then it was Graham, and we've seen that—
Just testing the waters.
They're testing the waters, but the problem is Mulvaney was testing the waters, his acting chief of staff, who isn't even his real chief of staff, at least as of now. So I just think Democrats see the chaos that's over there, and they're like, we have no political incentive to do this. We know that Trump will just make things up and drop things at the drop of a hat. So he's just going to do whatever he's going to do. So I think that Pelosi and Schumer have no incentive to do anything until there's an actual deal that the Republicans offer that actually makes some sense, that will work. And Democrats, by the way, you know, when they go back into session, the first thing they're going to do is vote to fund the government. And they're going to put it on the Senate, and the Senate's going to, like, reject it. And so I think Democrats feel like, look, we're going to do everything we can to open the government. We'll let the Republicans deal with the fallout. And as long as there's fallout, I think they feel like they are protected from that. And as of now, I don't see any path right now that the Republicans have to make themselves look better in this. So I don't think Pelosi's going to budge. There's no reason to.
Yeah. Anything else you want to add on that, Sean?
Yeah. The only thing I would add is two things. Number one, this issue really was a discrete issue with regards to border fence, border wall, whatever you want to call it, funding. And the, you know, Republicans actually surprisingly did come back after they had already left and passed that. What I think now, the fact that you have now a divided Congress, that changes the dynamic just from fence funding to a broader-based immigration reform proposal, which could include DACA, chain migration, a whole host of other issues. So I do think the dynamics have changed now, and the budget's going to be much more complicated. And I'm interested to see if this Officer Singh, who was killed over the holidays in the Central Valley, actually has any impact on Congress or not. The individual who killed him was not in the country legally.
Right. And I really quickly, just to give some background on that, and I know some folks were not tuned into the news over the holidays, it was a 33-year-old police officer, Ranil Singh, who was killed by a suspected drunk driver during a traffic stop. And 32-year-old Gustavo Perez Arriaga has been arrested for the shooting death of Officer Singh. Arriaga is an undocumented immigrant, and the local sheriff there has been saying that if they had been able to communicate more openly with immigration officials that the previous arrests that Arriaga had had for drunk driving and his gang affiliation would have meant that he would have been deported. You know, we only have a minute left here. And Matt, I know it's not too brief for this amount of information, but do you expect this to affect anything in Congress or maybe in California to relook at some of these policies and maybe the ways that they're implemented in local jurisdictions?
I think it's early to tell. I think we're going to have to see when everybody gets back from the new year to see if this story has more legs than it has right now. It's just early. It's a terrible story, obviously.
It's awful, yeah.
It's a horrible thing. Whether this catches the public's eye and imagination in a way that starts to move public policy, I just don't think we know.
Matt Rodriguez is joining me, Democratic strategist, alongside Shanti Walsh, Republican political analyst. I'm Libby Denkman, and for Larry Mantle, we're right back in a minute. Back to Air Talk on 89.3 KBCC. I'm Libby Denkman, filling in while Larry Mantle takes a vacation. I am talking to Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, as well as Shanti Walsh, Republican political analyst, during our weekly politics roundtable. We just went through the budget shutdown, guys, and of course, along with that issue is inextricably linked to children who are coming with their parents to the border, a lot of family crossings in the past year and a half or so. And last week on Christmas Eve, tragically, an 8-year-old Guatemalan boy died while in Customs and Border Protection custody. Al Jazeera reported that the boy was treated in the hospital initially for a common cold and then released. However, he was transferred back to a medical facility after he was nauseated and he was vomiting. He died shortly after midnight on December 25th, and an autopsy indicated that he had the flu. There was another tragic loss in the recent weeks. A 7-year-old Guatemalan girl was buried on Christmas Day after she died on December 8th, also in the custody of U.S. agents. Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Kevin McAleenan was on ABC's This Week on Sunday. He said his agents did everything that they could to save these children when it was clear that they were very sick, and he talked about preventing future tragedies.
What we've done immediately, Secretary Nielsen and I have directed that we do medical checks of children 17 and under as they come into our process. That's not a capacity we've had in the past. We've checked everyone we currently have in custody. We're working with ICE to make sure we can transfer them to a better situation for families and children as quickly as possible. But we're also trying to really change the system so that we have the capacity either with doctors, physicians, assistants, paramedics to do an initial intake check so that we know if a child is healthy as they arrive at the border and then make sure they can get medical care if they need it.
So McAleenan said that they're improving the medical checks for children, but he also went on to say that a barrier was necessary. That's the word that he used, partially a wall and other types of technology, surveillance technology. He said it was important to manage illegal entries and drug smuggling to free up resources for his agencies. Of course, these kids and their parents, they're mostly presenting themselves for asylum, which is legal. Sean Walsh, how do you grade the Trump administration's response to this tragedy so far and the overall situation with families arriving at the border?
It's just really tough. I mean, it's all tied in with politics. It's tied in with, humanity and compassion. And it's tied up with the fact that if there's many who believe, particularly on the Republican side and many in government, that if you do continue to let people in who are claiming refugee status with no evidence of refugee status, and the fact that they overwhelm the process to actually identifying whether you're a refugee or not, it just sends a loud and clarion call signal for more folks from Central America to get on the migrant path and come up to the border. So, there's an argument that if you don't actually enforce your people coming over now, you're just going to continue to have more and more people. Now, that said, it's also happening at an unfortunate time. I do know folks that are in government. I mean, they don't want to see something like this happen. It's the worst thing in the world for have law enforcement have someone die on your watch, and they are trying to watch these kids. But look, it's flu season now, and these people are in crowded situations, the migrants coming in. And so flu spreads in jails, and it spreads in college dorms because people are compacted in very close quarters and they pass germs around. So, it's not a surprise that kids are getting sick or other people are going to get sick, and I think people are going to continue to get sick you know, until we pass the flu season. So, you know, it's really no good answer, you know, other than to just open the doors wide open and, you know, let people come into the U.S. But I just don't think that's a tenable political situation for the president or Republicans.
And to follow up, Sean, I just know that Democrats would say that Trump administration policies like metering at the border that only let a few folks come through for processing for asylum a day, they're really pushing these people out to the outskirts and to away from legal entry points. And really, historically, illegal immigration is at an all-time low, or at least a recent history low, from about, you know, a million in the mid-2000s to today, about 500,000. Of course, the family situation has been growing, and that's a new kind of obstacle that the Obama administration and the Trump administration have faced. But do you think that there is a better way for the Trump administration to process asylum seekers so that they're not out in these very rugged and tough conditions and having a hard time, you know, finding water or other medical supplies as they cross?
Well, I think that, so I guess it's, when you look at government and you look at statistics, you say, well, it's at historic lows. There's only 521,090 people, you know, when they closed the government fiscal year, that were apprehended at the border. That was apprehended. You have more than 500,000 people that were apprehended at the border. You know, Lord knows how many others got through. And so, you know, there are real fundamental issues that are happen on the other side of the fence, which is when people get here, they have to then get into schools, they have to get into employment, they have to get into housing. There's a whole host of other complications. And, you know, honestly, you know, there's a very significant doubt about how many of those folks that are coming over are actually coming over from an asylum perspective, or how many are economic, and it's hard to sort out. The Mexican government actually is, in many respects, to be commended. They've been working pretty cooperatively with the U.S. government with regards to processing of migrants. So, you know, it's hard. It's a hard track. And, you know, you also say if you're going to start out from Guatemala or Nicaragua or El Salvador and literally walk for, you know, 1,000 miles, it's very treacherous all the way along the border. You can get robbed by people. You can get sick along the way. Lots of bad things can and do happen. And then you get to the border and people say, well, gosh, it's all on the U.S. I just don't think that's fair. It's complicated. I feel bad for the people. But, you know, from a government perspective, you do have to manage. You have a legal responsibility to enforce your laws and enforce your borders.
Matt Rodriguez is in studio with me, Democratic strategist. Of course, Kirstjen Nielsen, the Homeland Security Secretary, echoed that feeling that by providing a path to enter the country and stay in the country, there is a huge magnet for those dangerous crossings. What do you make of that, and how do you think that message is resonating, and what Sean was saying?
Yeah. Well, I agree with a lot of what Sean is saying, although we don't exactly know 100% what happened. There are still some questions as to both of these children. How well were they evaluated originally? They were in the boy's case, he was taken to the hospital. He had 103-degree fever. He was sent home, but he was only there for about an hour and a half. Why was he sent home? Homeland Security, the border folks are saying, well, that's what the hospital said. But then he immediately got sick, and they took him back. So and he seemed to go downhill particularly quickly. And so they've done a preliminary autopsy, but there's more they need to do to really find out exactly what happened. The challenge here is that you're just starting to see a lot more kids going in, and they're just not prepared for that. And Nielsen, while she did make some of the points that Sean made, I agree, she also couldn't answer how many deaths there had been on her watch. So this is another problem with the Trump administration. We've talked about this over the last couple of years. They just appear so incompetent on so many levels. So she goes in front of a member of Congress, and knowing they're going to get asked about this, and she doesn't even have answers. And this has been a continual problem with Nielsen at Homeland Security, and has been a general problem with I think the Trump administration. So it's difficult to take their word for things, one, because they sort of bend the truth, but also, two, there just is a general sense of chaos around this administration. And this is already a chaotic situation with people coming to the border and trying to get into this country. And so I think there's no question there's a magnet effect But what exactly happened once they got into U.S. custody, I don't think we know. Final thing I will say is this is going to where you're going to start to really see the difference between an all-Republican Congress and now a split Congress. Democrats are going to be very aggressive about starting to hold hearings around these items. We've seen these types of issues happen before, and they tend to sort of fade from public view quickly because Republican Congress is not – obviously have a vested interest in really doing a lot of oversight on some of these issues. This is going to be a much, much more aggressive Democratic Congress on some of these types of items. And I think you're going to see a lot more in terms of press reports, oversight, and reports being released by the Congress. And that could also put additional pressure on the Trump administration as these issues sort of head into 2019.
That's Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist. Sean T. Walsh, I'm curious what you think. We're going to talk about the new Congress and the balance of power in the House in just a few minutes. But on this issue, I know Elijah Cummings, who is incoming on oversight, I believe, has a letter prepared where he's going to be asking for more information about the numbers of children who were separated from their families and exactly their names and where they are, and trying to track that data a little bit more closely. But I have heard noises from the Republican side that this is an issue that they may be willing to do more bipartisan work with their Democratic colleagues on, in terms of making sure that these children and families are being handled correctly. What do you make of the new Congress coming in on this specific issue when it comes to child separations at the border?
Well, look, I mean, that is, if you're looking for a poster child or a documentary or something about tearing at the heartstrings, a child dying in custody of flu, or parents being taken away from their kids and little kids in cages, I mean, that really tears people's hearts and tears their emotional side, you know, apart. And so, of course, I think anybody, and particularly politicians who have certain cockroachian-like qualities, don't want to see that kind of attack being put forward on them. I do think that there would be a bipartisan way to try and make it more comfortable for the kids.
I mean, because, sorry to interrupt, Sean, but that was something we heard in the campaigns in Orange County, that conservative candidates in Orange County still were willing to separate themselves from the president on this one issue, this immigration and child separations issue.
Excuse me, like I said, no surprise at all. I think it's politics. One thing I want to get back at, Libby, I mean, what people forget, you know, last year, 80,000 Americans died from the complications of flu. 900,000 people got the flu. There was only...
Yeah. I'm so sorry. Sean, we're going to come back in just 1 second. I'll let you finish that thought. Sean T. Walsh, Republican political analyst and partner at Wilson Walsh Consulting. Also, Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist in studio. It's Air Talk. I'm Libby Denkman. Welcome back to Air Talk on 89.3 KBCC. Libby Denkman here with you, in for Larry Mantle. Also in the studio with me is Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, and on the line is Sean T. Walsh, Republican political analyst. And guys, I want to get your take, because General John Kelly is leaving the White House. Today is actually his last technical day on the job as White House Chief of Staff. He gave an interview to the LA Times that got a lot of attention. Maggie Haberman basically just took it and ran it in the New York Times as well, which was kind of interesting. The story included General Kelly talking about his tenure, but it also included a lot of his supporters kind of saying, don't look just at what the General Kelly did as chief of staff. Look at what he prevented in terms of decisions that could have come. And Matt Rodriguez, he mentioned things like pulling out of NATO, or at least these supporters did, or pulling troops out of South Korea. What do you make of General Kelly's exit interview?
Makes you feel really comfortable when the chief of staff says, look at the things that I didn't do, I kept him from doing. Makes you really feel solid about what's going on in the White House. I thought it was a little early to do this. Usually they wait like a month or two to do some glossy piece in Vogue or something where he, you know, talks about all how great he is, and you wait a little while. He sort of did it on his way out the door.
He was getting ahead of the spin, I suppose.
I guess so. I mean, you know, so I thought it was a little early to do this, especially with the LA Times. I thought he would just choose a different kind of venue. I love the LA Times, but I just thought he would do a different kind of format for this. All that said, Trump is just, he's just like the center of all universes. You know, he's like the ultimate sun here. So everyone revolves around him. Other politicians, the Congress, almost like pop culture at this point, the news, every TV show, and same thing. So I guess Kelly is having his shot. You know, he's a little more reserved than some of the other people who have left the administration, obviously, and certainly the biggest or the most notable one in the past few weeks has been Secretary of Defense Mattis leaving and that letter that he sent.
But when Mattis left, he had a letter that kind of explained policy differences, support for allies, things that seem to be a specific split. Kelly's exit seems to be, and the president probably wanted him out for some time, but also that the job is just, in his words, bone crushing.
Well, the job is. I mean, chiefs, that's why if you look, people always look at those photos of pictures of presidents over the course of their presidency, how much worse they look. Look at the chiefs of staff. I mean, they're talking, if you read the article, he was up at 4 a.m. every day. He was going home at 9 or 10. That's pretty typical.
And still working when he got home.
No, that's every administration. I mean, you get back, you're doing some emails or, you know, sleeping with your BlackBerry or iPhone or whatever next to you, and you get fitful sleep for 2, 3, 4 hours and you go. That is a physically grueling and demanding thing for anybody at any age. And he's been working now for 40, 50 years between the military and now public service. So, look, I mean, these jobs are very, very, very difficult physically and psychologically. And at some point, you just need to move on. And so I take that at face value. I thought Kelly's, you know, acquitted himself. Some of his policy issues I've not necessarily agreed with, but I think he's done the best he could under pretty fairly difficult circumstances. It seems like it's a very chaotic White House, not just because of Trump, but because of the friends and allies and family plan that Trump seems to have going on in the West Wing. So I think he did the best that he could. I think probably physically and mentally he was done, and now we're going to just move on. But it's funny how these things go. He'll be completely forgotten within 2 or 3 weeks. You know, these chiefs of staff, once they get cycled out, will be like, remember when was John Kelly chief of staff again? It'll have that feel to it. So
they're sort of, you know, behind the curtain conducting a lot of what's happening, but they're not in the public eye.
I remember when Bill Daley left Obama, when he was gone, it was like, was that guy actually chief of staff? Yeah, and there's an element of this here, but it was his time, and we'll see what happens next with in the White House.
Sean Walsh, what do you make of John Kelly and his exit comments? I know that there were also things that he said about the wall, basically saying that the Trump administration had abandoned the idea of an actual physical wall as being the main goal, and that there was a combination of technology and a smart border security that would be part of that. The president disagreed with that on Twitter this morning. What do you make of what Kelly had to say?
I think what Kelly was trying to say is similar to what they have in Israel. Israel put up a border security fence. It's a double fence that has technology involved in it, as well as, a host of other issues that they use, surveillance technology. So the border along the southern border between Mexico and the United States is very rugged. Some areas a wall or a stronger physical barrier makes sense. Others, it's just basically a mountain, and you can't really put a wall into something like that, or unless it's the Great Wall of China, I guess. But so I think he was talking about a variety of issues. I also think with regards to what Matt had to say, chiefs of staff do come and they do go. They're enormously powerful, influential people if they do their jobs right, because they, in essence, at least historically, get to decide who the president really sees. Probably 80% of the people that the president sees is controlled mostly by the chief of staff.
Gatekeeper.
And the truth of the matter is, historically, the most valuable thing in government really is the president's time. Who gets in front of the president? What time does they get? And then what decisions emanate from there? 98%, 99% of government is actually run by the cabinet secretary, in many respects, the chief of staff, for the day-to-day decisions, and the president makes the big decisions. I don't think that's the case in this White House, to be honest with you. I think the president decides kind of what he wants to do, and then the entire government lurches in that direction. So I think he's going to be missed. One thing I will say is I do hope that Mulvaney becomes the chief of staff, and I say that because he has a lot of experience understanding budget and complex government issues, and I think he can actually manage the governance of the country when the president's off focused on other issues. He'll keep his eye on the ball and make sure that the trains run on time and the, you know, checks get in the mail.
And a former congressman, so somebody who has more political experience than what Kelly was going in with, and possibly will be able to work those angles a little bit more, maybe improve a relationship with the Hill, do you think, Sean?
Yeah, I think that's right. And the truth of the matter is, the president really does need. So I talked to somebody who had a conversation with outgoing senator who I'll remain nameless. And I was surprised because I thought this person was going to be very unkind towards President Trump. And he said, you know, he got invited by President Trump over to watch a movie over there. And he said Trump was very personable. And the senator said something that really surprised me. He said that, you know, President Obama really didn't reach out to Congress much at all. He was fairly aloof.
I've heard a similar thing about the Obama administration, that they weren't as communicative and they weren't as collegial as prior administrations and apparently as the Trump administration in terms of, you know, sometimes it comes down to social occasions and slapping backs and shaking hands to start those conversations. Sean Walsh, just quickly moving on, because we did have an announcement this morning from Elizabeth Warren getting into the 2020 race, sort of. She's forming an exploratory committee for her presidential bid. That lets her raise money and hire staff, things like that. We only have about 40 seconds left for you, Sean. Sorry to cut you a little short, but what do you make of the Democratic field?
It's going to be a crowded pool, and it's going to be, I think, an ugly contest between the left and the Democratic Party and the more centrist in the Democratic Party. And if Matt wants to run for president, he's going to run on the BlackBerry ticket, and I'll be his vice president.
If you'd like to announce, Matt, this is your platform. I mean,
I was actually already looking on the internet to see how much money Sean had given to Elizabeth Warren's exploratory committee. I think that I know he's going to be a big funder for her.
So, I will. I'll be holding my sign out in front of all of her rallies. Go, Elizabeth.
Yes, exactly. This is going to be a complete circus. There's going to be a lot of people getting in from all sorts of sides on this. And she's the first, which I'm actually surprised more candidates have not gotten in early. I don't know what they're waiting for. And sometimes I think it does make sense to wait. In this case, I think it's important to get out, plant a flag early, and make yourself a kind of counterweight to Trump. There's going to be so much pressure on all these other candidates. They got to get moving. So I think Warren, I don't think actually Warren has a chance at this. I think she's been irrevocably damaged both by her Native American video, as well as I just think her time was 2016. I think there are other places for progressives and other folks to go. We'll see. But either way, I do think it was a smart move for her to get out early.
Yeah. Why isn't a Biden or a Sanders officially jumped in yet? I mean, they're kind of foregone conclusions, right?
Well, it's hard to tell. I think Sanders almost seems for sure. Biden, I think so. Yeah, Biden's the one I really don't know why he hasn't gotten in, because he's almost like a pseudo incumbent. And mm-hmm. If I were he, I would be going in, taking the Obama mantle and saying, I'm essentially the establishment Democratic candidate and I'm here to run.
Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, and Sean T. Walsh was on the line with me, Republican political analyst. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for being with me today. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle. We'll have more after the news and this quick break. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman, reporter here at KPCC, sitting in for Larry Mantle for the day while Larry takes some time off. And this hour, we're talking about an issue that I cover in my reporting beat, veterans and military service, and about how caring for military veterans and how we can do that the best for the benefit of all. There is one of the most devastating results of war that mental health professionals that care for veterans face is PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and the mental health effects that linger long after military service. That's the focus of this discussion, because the West Los Angeles Veterans Health Administration in Brentwood is right now in this big process of overhauling its 388-acre campus. Part of that plan is to consolidate medical care, including mental health care, and they want to move it all to the south side of the grounds below Wilshire Boulevard. That will make way for this new future planned town center on the north side, including 1,200 units of supportive housing for homeless veterans. And one of the buildings in the process of this move that has had to be cleared out is Building 256, which was the home to one of the oldest PTSD clinics in the nation. Veterans who formerly attended group therapy sessions in the building are protesting this move. They say it has virtually shut down the PTSD treatment that they relied on for years. I've invited one of those veterans to join me in the studio today as well as one of the mental health care professionals who treated veterans in West LA for many years. First off, I want to welcome Michael Filonis, an Army veteran who served in Vietnam, and he's now an architect here in Los Angeles. Hi, Michael. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Also in the studio is Leslie Martin, a licensed clinical social worker and former director of the PTSD Outpatient Services Team, or POST, at the West Los Angeles VA. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Libby. Thanks.
Thanks so much to both of you. I want to note that we have invited the Greater Los Angeles VA healthcare system to join this discussion. They have been working to get a representative to talk on the program. I know that it's difficult, especially the VA has many layers and many folks that you have to talk to in order to get a spokesperson on the line. So we appreciate their work. I hope that they are able to, find somebody to join this conversation either now or at a future date. First off, I want to start with Leslie. Can you talk to me about how you first started working with veterans?
Yes, actually, it was quite by accident. Sometimes life gives you road signs and you wind up exactly where you should be. So when I went back to get my degree, I found myself working as an intern at the VA in 1988. And it was very clear to me that homeless veterans needed a lot of help. And that was my direction as a clinical social worker from then on. And I started with the VA domiciliary program. And that segued into working with homeless veterans with post-traumatic stress with a concentration for combat veterans. And that segued into doing group work on Tuesday and Thursday evenings, which was practically unheard of to have evening groups.
And about what year did those groups start?
I can tell. Well, they started back in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really come into the picture. Pardon my Chicago cold voice. didn't come into the picture until 1988. And then it was very clear that because the numbers were growing, that my partner then and I were doing two groups on a Tuesday, two groups on a Thursday, and seeing on any of those nights possibly 100 veterans between the two of us. And then we said, this has to be a program. This has to be a program. So in 1997, August 1st, we opened the POST program, PTSD, Outpatient Services Team.
Mm-hmm. And so this was kind of born out of this need that you saw, especially as more and more veterans were coming in for care. And a lot of them at that time probably were Vietnam era veterans, or who were you seeing?
They were. There were still vestiges of the World War II POW population, and they were unfortunately dying off. And Korean vets were sort of coming in, leaving, largely Vietnam veterans. And then subsequently, after the POST opened its doors, we started getting, especially once we went into Iraq, we started getting people from Iraq, Afghanistan, but also many other wars that people forget about. Bosnia, Kosovo, they weren't declared wars, but, if people stand in front of bullets, I consider that eligible for combat.
And by the time the POST program kind of became at its peak, what was the size like? How many veterans were you serving, and how big of a kind of facility were you using?
Okay, we have a wonderful facility in Building 256 that we made into kind of a welcome home center as well. At any given time, we had a fluid population of 1,000. What do I mean fluid? It's not the same 1,000 guys sitting in the same group room for 34 years. And I can tell you that between 300 and 350 vets came through our program every single week, either for group therapy, individual therapy to see a psychiatrist, or sometimes just to hang out and be with their fellow vets.
Yeah. And Michael, in the studio with me right now, Michael Filonis, a Vietnam-era veteran himself who served in the Army, what was your experience walking into the PTSD program? Why did you arrive there, and what did you find?
I wasn't eager to get into a program. I thought I could handle the baggage from the war on my own. And so 46 years later, mm-hmm. after the war, on August 8th of 2015, I decided, because my anger was escalating, lack of friends, lack of trust of almost everyone, I decided that I needed to get some help because I was afraid my marriage might be in jeopardy. So, sorry.
No, it's okay. I understand. It's really difficult, especially to talk about this on a microphone.
A friend of the family suggested that I call someone at the VA. His name was Jim Dwyer. And so I called Jim, left a message, didn't get him. And I guess I just felt better after I had called him. And Finally, we got in touch with one another, and he said, you know, why don't you come over to the VA? And we made an appointment, and I did. I was a little reluctant, but I thought, you know, if this is going to help, I've got to do something about it. I walked into his office and automatically felt comfortable. He was a Vietnam vet. Shortly thereafter, maybe a meeting or two after that, I met Leslie, and both just wonderful people that you could tell cared about us as veterans. And the issues that we were going through, and just great listeners, lots of help. And that was the beginning of me going to the VA. And then Jim said at one point, I think you might be a good candidate for our PTSD group. And I was not really very excited about the group experience.
Initially, it sounded a little, scary or kind of overwhelming?
Well, you know, I didn't know who these people were. I knew they were Vietnam vets. It's when you get into a group, you have to trust people before you can speak to anybody.
Yeah.
And I automatically.
It's okay.
I automatically just felt these were my brothers. And now they're all now that they're real friends that I have in the world.
Yeah.
Libby, can I interject?
Absolutely. Leslie Martin is on in the studio with us as well, a clinical social worker with the VA, and we're talking with Michael Filonis, an Army veteran. And Leslie, for many years, directed the PTSD outpatient services team in West Los Angeles, which has now been moved, and many of the group therapy sessions that were operating at the VA have disbanded now because of the move. And Leslie, what would you like to say?
I would like to say, because of the degree of difficulty that Mike and most of the guys have talking about this, that the miracle of the groups, the things that have kept this program alive and functioning at the level it has, which is in almost 21 years, one suicide. And during all those years, maybe 1% of our veterans, over 1,000 in count, have returned to inpatient care, which is a record that when I talk to people from other stations find spectacular. Michael used the word because they listen, because they care. And that translates to the rest of the guys in the group. And it doesn't take long. You know, you're in a cold, cruel world out there. You feel alone. You feel isolated. You feel that you've been shafted. You walk into a place, and when we say welcome home, we really mean welcome home.
Yeah. Leslie, I just have to close here really quickly. We're going to come right back after this break, and I want to get into why the program has moved and its effect on what's going on now in West L.A. It's an important issue that affects veterans in our community. I'll be right back in just a moment. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle, here on KPCC. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle today. And we're talking about how we treat military veterans who have returned from service, and perhaps they are holding on to some mental health effects of war. The West L.A. VA campus in Brentwood, it's kind of wedged between Brentwood and Westwood. It's this giant 388-acre campus, and a lot of the buildings on the campus are beautiful Mission Revival style from the early 20th century. Gorgeous buildings. Many of them have fallen into disrepair, however, and there has been a major push in recent years because of a lawsuit by homeless veterans to remake that campus and provide housing, provide better services, to really redo the entire West LA VA campus, all 388 acres of it. And in the process of that change, there was a choice to consolidate medical services on the south side of campus. And that meant that a VA PTSD clinic that served 1,000 veterans, you know, at any given time, had to relocate to the south side of campus, to out of a Mission Revival style building to something that was a little bit more medical, a little smaller, and, you know, was a facility that many of the veterans
decided was just not right for the types of groups that had been long meeting in Building 256 on the north side of campus. Joining me right now is Leslie Martin, licensed clinical social worker and former director of the PTSD outpatient services team that used to meet in that 256 building. She has now left the VA, right, Leslie?
Correct.
And was this because of this move that was announced, what, a year and a half ago or a year ago, to move the clinic and to change the facilities?
My leaving is directly attributable to retaliation because it was alleged that I manipulated my veterans into writing letters of protest. Well, if anybody has ever met our veterans, they know that they don't need manipulation.
And you filed a whistleblower complaint over this situation of the moving of the clinic and the closing of several of the groups. There are some groups still meeting the new building, Building 401, on the south side of campus. So the program continues, but in a much diminished capacity.
Much diminished capacity, absolutely. We never said we wouldn't move. That's falsehood number one. We were trying our best to negotiate for another space in a couple of other buildings. To a space that would accommodate the program's needs, which was approximately 20 groups a week, with a population, the groups from anywhere between 5 and 30 people, for about 40 hours of programming a week. Full disclosure, nobody did 40 hours a week. If they did 3 to 5 groups a week, that was a heavy program. Nevertheless, all of that availability was certainly at hand. So we were told about a year and a half ago, maybe it's coming on 2 years now, that we would be moving south of campus. Well, things move slowly at the VA, as with any organization. But Dr. Barry Guzet, who is the chief of mental health and psychiatry, was pretty adamant about consolidating all those services, as you just said.
And to just mention that we have invited the VA on today. They were unable, because of the tight timelines of live radio, they were unable to get a spokesperson to join me. I did speak to a clinical psychologist at the VA in the spring when I covered this story as a reporter, and they said that the consolidation of the medical services on the south side of campus would allow for more convenience of care, because they would all be in one place, that there would be an expansion of care beyond just combat veterans that you serve, Leslie, and that it would include military sexual trauma survivors and women veterans. So the VA thinks that this is a good thing for veterans to move to the south side of campus.
Understood. And I'm aware of that. What the VA didn't tell you was that they didn't hear that, in fact, we have for all of these years offered this evidence-based practices they're talking about, 12 to 14-week courses, which gets clinical. We don't have to go into that.
We will go into it in just one second. Okay. I have somebody not commenting on this direct story in the West LA, but I did want to bring somebody on who could talk about evidence-based practices, because it's sort of the subject of what the VA is moving towards, is this, and I know it's very clinical and I'm not an expert in it, but it's a limited course of treatment. From what I understand, it's a 12 or so week course, and they call it evidence-based versus the open-ended support groups that you run or ran at the VA for many years, and that Michael Filonis, Army veteran who sits with me here, were part of. And Leslie, what do you think about that larger move that the VA seems to be making away from open-ended group therapy towards evidence-based short-term treatment?
Well, since we've been doing evidence-based treatment for over 20 years, I certainly am not going to say that it doesn't work. It doesn't work freestanding. When you have veterans who have multiple issues, I mean, if somebody trips and bumps their head and they are traumatized from that, that's a lot easier to treat with evidence-based in 12 weeks. We're talking about people whose lives have been totally disrupted and their entire social structure has been disrupted. Family relationships, work relationships, substance abuse, all of these things are a direct result of no communication with other human beings. We are herd animals. We have to have that interaction. The VA has called them social clubs. Well, that's a rather pithy.
The VA called your support groups
social clubs. They also said that we were ineffective and inefficient.
And that has to be hard to hear, of course. I do want to bring on my guest that's on the line, David Riggs, a professor of medical and clinical psychology and executive director of the Center for Deployment Psychology at the Uniformed Services University in Bethesda, Maryland. And David, you are obviously in Maryland. You're not commenting on this issue on the West LA campus. It's very local. But can you describe for me what is evidence-based treatment? What does it mean, and how does it compare to support groups that say these PTSD veterans, suffering veterans in West LA, have been attending for many years?
Certainly, and thank you for having me on. Evidence-based therapies are probably the easiest way to understand them are treatments that have been subjected to rigorous scientific testing to show that they're effective at alleviating symptoms of whatever the target disorder would be, in this case, PTSD. So these are treatments that, much like a medication, would be tried against a placebo. They've been tried against various alternate therapies and shown to be more effective at reducing PTSD symptoms than the alternatives are. And your other guest was commenting about the value of seeing these treatments in the context of broader treatment, some of which may be supportive groups and so on. And I would second that I think oftentimes veterans will find value in multiple approaches or in support that's offered at the same time that they're receiving a targeted treatment. What we find oftentimes, though, is that clinicians or clients will not engage in an evidence-based treatment because the support groups or other types of treatments that haven't been shown to be effective are available. And that would be a concern. I don't know in the situation there in LA.
Sure.
But, you know, we would certainly encourage people who are struggling with PTSD to seek treatments that have been shown to work to alleviate those symptoms.
And Professor Riggs, I'm curious because I know in response to a letter from Ted Lieu, the congressman in West LA, who is a military veteran himself, he was concerned about the move of the clinic. Secretary Wilkie at the Veterans Administration mentioned that group therapy does not have the same type of medical research supporting it that evidence-based, you know, set weeks of treatment have. Have you observed a broader shift in veteran treatment across the country away from groups that have been, you know, something that veterans have relied on for many years?
I want to be a little cautious about this and say that there's like group therapy describes a way in which therapy is delivered. And in that it's delivered to a group of clients at the same time, and there are processes that happen in those settings that can be valuable and useful, but doesn't describe a particular set of techniques, whereas the evidence-based therapies typically identify a set of techniques that when applied, can help alleviate symptoms.
And can you give me an example of those techniques?
Certainly. So there's a treatment called cognitive processing therapy, which uses cognitive therapy techniques. There's another one called prolonged exposure therapy that uses behavioral and exposure-based techniques to alleviate the distress associated with PTSD. And the reason I raised the distinction between technique and delivery form is that cognitive processing therapy, for example, has been delivered in groups, but uses the techniques of CPT in that group setting.
And Professor Riggs, I'm running out of time here for this segment, but we're going to hold on to you for the rest of the hour. In studio with me right now is Michael Filonis, an Army veteran who served in the Vietnam War. And Michael, did you want to respond to what Professor Riggs is speaking about?
Yes. First of all, I took a CPT course. We started off, I think, with about 14 combat vets. There were two of us that completed the course. It's very intense, and it's not, and it's, you really have to be, I think, ready and able to stick with a 12-week program. So, I've done that. I've done an anger management. There was about 12 that started the anger management group. I was the only one that finished it.
So these are intensive programs that aren't always hitting people at the right time in their treatment. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
But the most important thing is that coupled with the group, these two systems can coexist.
Mm-hmm. And Michael, I'm so sorry. We're going to come right back after this break. I appreciate you sticking with me. I'm Libby Denkman in for Air Talk. Back right after this. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. I'm talking with a combat veteran and architect who lives in Los Angeles. He's a Vietnam War veteran. Michael Filonis is in studio. Also Leslie Martin, a licensed clinical social worker and former director of the PTSD Outpatient Services Team at the West Los Angeles VA. And Leslie, we heard from Michael just a moment ago about his experience with evidence-based treatment, that is these limited 12-week courses that the VA is starting to shift towards. And unfortunately, your experience at the VA was that a large and popular group therapy clinic that you had been running for quite some time that included evidence-based treatment as well was moved last fall, just a few months ago. And since then, what has happened? What has been your experience with what occurred when the clinic moved up until now?
Of course, I was not part of the move. What I hear, and I hear a lot, is that the groups have been diminished. The major groups on Tuesday night and Thursday nights, which were inclusive for both military sexual trauma, substance abuse, combat, and non-combat veterans, that group on Thursday night no longer exists. And that had a population weekly of between 25 and 30 people. They're just not getting that service. The Tuesday night group officially moved itself. These guys took the initiative, moved to a space in the community to perpetuate the group. And I volunteer as facilitator there now that I'm no longer affiliated with the VA.
And where are they meeting now? I know I want to shout out to Gail Holland at the LA Times, because
absolutely,
I know she wrote a wonderful piece about this entire situation. And, you know, she highlighted that the fact that the groups have, many of them have disbanded or moved. Where is that Tuesday night group meeting now?
It's at the Felicia Mahood Senior Center. I don't have the exact address. It's Santa Monica Boulevard near Sawtell in West Los Angeles.
But they basically, these veterans have had to choose to meet off campus. And why is that, Michael Filonis, Army veteran who has been part of this therapy at the VA for many years? Why was the new facility on the south side of campus, where some groups are still meeting, why was that not sufficient for your groups?
They would not have anybody come from the clinician side after 5 o'clock. And a lot of us work. And so it's convenient that we meet from 6 to 7:30 in the evenings. There's a number of men that are, as I said, are still working. And so that hasn't become convenient. One point that I'd like to make, I looked at the master plan for the North Campus. And Building 256 is not scheduled for to be converted into anything else other than mental health. So the point of why would we move when we're dealing with mental health issues? Why would we need to move out of a facility that already works? It's because they wanted to get rid of us, the program, Leslie, Jim Dwyer. And these folks at the VA, including the director, Ann Brown, Dr. Guzet, Dr. Spangler, should be ashamed of themselves to get rid of a program that works. If it didn't work, we wouldn't have continued it. And we are paying out of our own pockets to rent this space. There are other states that continue the PTSD program.
Group therapy.
Group therapy program. We've been told this by a doctor that was coming and visiting us. So it's a local decision, not a national decision, that they must go away. The local folks who I mentioned earlier just made a decision that they weren't going to do this any longer.
And I do want to again say we've invited the VA to come on and share their perspective on this. When I spoke with Dr. Spangler and a number of folks at the VA earlier this year on this issue, they said that the consolidation of mental health care on the south side of campus would be a positive thing for veterans and, again, expand services. Obviously, Michael, you feel very strongly that that has not been the case for you. You know, what's next? I mean, how are emotionally the other members of your groups that are not able to meet on the campus anymore, how are they faring?
Very, very well. We had an end of a year dinner that one of the guys made an Italian dinner for all of us. And, you know, the word was that we were all very, very happy that we're continuing the group, that Leslie has become an integral part. We can't do it by ourselves. We need somebody that's a trained clinician that is there, can lead the group, can help us work through issues. And these are not all combat issues, combat-related issues. These are daily issues, you know, about family members and losing a friend. I'm speechless to say that this program cannot continue in its current state. And if we need to, it'll grow. And we would welcome other veterans to join our group. And if it gets so big that we can't handle it, we'll find another space for them.
And Leslie, what is next? Because this kind of model with the veterans kind of meeting on their own, and luckily they have you as a trained mediator and licensed clinical social worker to conduct these groups. But what do you think about the future? This doesn't seem like it's a sustainable model for everyone.
I think that's probably true. What I would like to see is an administration at the VA, in mental health especially, that actually cares about the veteran. There is a lot of talk given to patient-centered care. And really, in my experience, it and the experience of many other clinicians, has been that the patient that we're caring for is the computer, that it has become depersonalized, that Director Brown has not ever, despite many invitations, ever once come up to our unit, let alone sit in on a group. Dr. Guzet has been up to a staff meeting, doesn't know the vets. On May 8th, there was a meeting of 50 of our vets and a panel of leadership. Expressing their concerns meant nothing to these people. Mm. They were told, we were told, that if they needed more support after the evidence-based treatment, they were to go to the vet center or get each other's phone numbers. Mm-hmm. PTSD is not cured with 12 to 14 weeks, working in tandem with ongoing support, ongoing education groups. They told us that we could no longer do a spouse's group that we had done for years, that for some reason, unless the spouse had a chart of her own, was a veteran, that we could not administer services to her.
And I do just want to mention, you know, I was at a town hall in which many of the members of the post clinic, the PTSD clinic that you formerly directed, stood up and spoke to Ann Brown, the director of the hospital there on the VA campus, director of medical operations. I know I'm getting her title slightly mixed up, but she listened and she did seem receptive to the feedback. And the message from the VA was that they were going to have those meetings and that there would be some changes to accommodate the special needs of this group to make sure that there was space, that there was privacy to meet. But you are shaking your head. It sounds like it hasn't. You did not experience that happening.
I did not experience it happening. And I don't think anybody who has moved to Building 401 has experienced that. It's simply an inadequate space. Three group rooms to be shared with the mental health clinic and one other program. They have, as you said, the treatment has been diminished. It's been gutted, mm-hmm. eviscerated.
And I do want to just mention that Dove and Sherman Oaks had called in First Lieutenant Green Beret, veteran and a member of the group. And, you know, he says that this group was really important to him because of some of the very serious things that he saw in Vietnam. And he doesn't believe that the evidence-based treatment is right for him. He needs the group therapy to continue. So thank you, Dove, for calling in. Just briefly here, because we only have about 30 seconds left, Leslie, what's next for this process? Or maybe, Michael, you want to jump in. Are you going to continue to protest this move?
We'll do whatever we can do to continue. Hopefully, at some point, we'll be back in Building 256, which is scheduled for mental health care. And hopefully Leslie will be there with us and Jim Dwyer.
Thank you so much, Michael Filonis, Army veteran from the Vietnam era, and Leslie Martin, who's a licensed clinical social worker with formerly with the West LA VA, and also David Riggs, who joined us from the Uniformed Services University in Bethesda, Maryland. I'm Libby Denkman with AirTalk.